High-yield bonds and senior secured loans have continued to garner significant investor interest in recent months. And maybe that's not all that surprising, given the attractive income they offer and an economic backdrop that continues to surprise to the upside. But as market conditions continue to evolve and risks from geopolitics to inflation remain top of mind, investors are rightly asking, can high yield continue its strong run?
Despite really strong returns in 2023, all-in yields remain attractive. We think leveraged loans are particularly compelling right now, but whether you're talking about loans or bonds, US or Europe, it's important to remember that these are below investment grade asset classes, and you really need big teams on the ground doing the bottom-up credit selection that's required to be successful in these markets.
That was Brian Pacheco, a portfolio manager within Barings Global High Yield Group. And this is Streaming Income, a podcast from Barings. I'm your host, Greg Campion. Coming up on the show, high yield bonds and loans, adapting to changing markets. Before we get into the conversation, if you're not already following us and you're interested in hearing our latest thoughts on asset classes like high yield, private credit, real estate, and more, just search Streaming Income on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. With that, here's my conversation with Brian Pacheco. All right, Brian, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Excited to have you here. You are a first-time guest on the podcast, so excited to dive in and talk about high-yield bonds and loans with you today. And since it's your first time on the podcast, I was thinking maybe we would just start with like a quick intro. I think you're a pretty well-known person around the firm here, and I'm sure to many of our clients as well, but maybe some of our listeners and our viewers out there haven't been exposed to you yet. So tell me a little bit just about your role at the firm here at Barings, the team that you're on, and then maybe a little bit about what you were doing before this role.
Sure. So my name's Brian Pacheco. I'm a global high-yield portfolio manager. I'm part of a team of over 70 investment professionals, over half of which are analysts that do bottom-up credit analysis. I focus on multi-asset credit, high-yield, leverage loans. Prior to my current role, I was the sector head for the U.S. commodities team, and my focus and coverage responsibilities were in the energy sector.
Awesome. Thank you for that overview. Part of a very large team here. I think one of the largest high yield teams in the industry. It's always a pleasure to get to interact with you and the team here. That energy background, I'm sure, comes in handy when you are evaluating high yield opportunities. I don't think this conversation is going to devolve into a debate about the oil price, but
I hope not.
At least I think I have the right person in front of me who's well qualified if it does. Well, let's get into the discussion about high yield more broadly. And, maybe to kind of set the stage for that, I want to talk a little macro first. So you were a part of our 2024 Credit Outlook panel that we hosted back in November. Just thinking back on that time, I recall you as being generally bullish on high yield bonds and loans.
Thanks for remembering that.
that call has proven to be fairly prescient so far. But that was against a pretty different backdrop. It's only 4 or 5 months ago, but if you think back of what we were looking at then, we were talking about, I think there was a lot of worries that the economy was about to slow down. There was obviously calls for, quite a few rate cuts in 2024. Today, things have seemingly changed a little bit. So maybe let's just start high level. Tell me about the kind of overall landscape for high yield and maybe how that's changed.
Sure. Yeah. So when we recorded our panel in early November, I think the term that was being thrown around a lot was hard-ish landing. Mm-hmm. So the expectation was that we were going to have a slowdown and or recession that was going to cause some credit problems, but that was going to open the door for Federal Reserve interest rate cuts, and effectively the Fed put would be back in play, and that would keep things from getting too bad. So following that recording, we had a couple very favorable CPI prints. The Fed had a very dovish pivot in December, which really put gasoline on the fire, and we had a massive rally going into year end. I think high yield returned something like 8%. And a lot of folks called it an everything rally because you had both treasuries rallying and risk assets rallying. So as the calendar year turned, we were priced for perfection. Someone would call that priced for immaculate disinflation. Mm. And the expected Federal Reserve interest rate cuts by the market had increased to something like 150 basis points. Mm-hmm. Fast forward to today, the data has not been cooperative, meaning the economy has been almost too strong. Inflation has been sticky. We had a couple hot CPI prints. And rates have essentially round-tripped. The market's now predicting about 40 basis points of interest rate cuts. And the narrative has gone from, you know, a soft-ish landing back to potentially no landing. And we're back to higher for longer. Mm-hmm. So higher for longer benefits leveraged loans, which we really like, and it benefits short duration assets that are high quality and offering favorable yields.
So let's talk about loans as an asset class. You know, rightly or wrongly, I think there is a perception out there that loans can be viewed as a play on interest rates. All right. So this is a very simplistic way to look at it, but if as a floating rate asset class, rates go up, maybe it's time to buy loans. Rates go down, maybe it's time to sell loans. So I guess what I'd like to ask you is two things. One, first, is that too simplistic of a way to look at the asset class? And two, you know, you mentioned that you and the team are constructive on loans. Let's get into that. Let's understand, you know, what that case is today.
Sure. Well, I don't really think about loans as a play on rates, although your point is well taken that if rates are going up, you want to be in a short duration asset class, and loans are as short as it gets at close to zero. I think of loans as an income generating asset class with low volatility. That income component is why over the last 25 years in the U.S. at least, there's only been three negative total return years in loans. And in Europe, I think it's only been four negative total return years. That income component is now sitting at 9%, which is very high relative to the long-term average in the mid-fives. Mm-hmm. So the reason we're bullish on loans is you have that high contractual income, you have a strong economic backdrop, corporate balance sheets are in good shape, and it's really one of our favorite asset classes, and we're max overweight in our multi-asset credit funds as a result.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in a number of your multi-asset credit strategies, you all have the ability to move in between loans and bonds, U.S. and Europe, some other asset classes like CLOs, and that's very interesting to hear that you're, would it be kind of very much toward the top end of where you've been historically in terms of the allocation of those strategies and loans?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
We include CLOs in that because mm-hmm. we like CLO liabilities for the same reasons we like loans. Mm-hmm. But yes, we're sort of finding, you know, the upper bound of what we think is appropriate.
Okay. Now, you had kind of alluded to the steady nature of the returns in loans. Talk to me a little bit about that, because I think that's a, you know, potentially underappreciated point, especially when you consider time periods like the one you were referencing earlier, like the end of last year. Tell me a little bit more just about that idea of that return stream.
So when you look at the return profile over last year, for example, loans made money maybe every month, if not every month, almost every single month. So mm-hmm. it was sort of a steady path to that 13% or so return. Mm-hmm. High yield, on the other hand, which is an asset class we also like but has longer duration, earned about two-thirds of the total return in really the last 2 months of the year.
Yeah,
and because you had spread tightening and you had rates rally.
Yeah.
You'd see it even more in IG,
exactly,
and sort of the more duration you have,
yep,
the more you see that impact.
That's right. Yeah, I think IG and some of the emerging market debt asset classes were very heavily concentrated their returns into that last 6 weeks of the year. So that was kind of shows this point of just kind of the juxtaposing loans versus bonds and what that return profile looks like.
Yeah, so sometimes in thinking about that 9%, if you just break it down monthly, it's even more obvious. It's 75 basis points every single month you're earning by owning loans. So to get to sort of tactical on your entry point to us just doesn't make a lot of sense because the opportunity cost of that carry is significant.
Yeah. Now, where are we from a valuation perspective? Because I know, and we'll talk about bonds, and I know there's maybe some people who are concerned that, you know, we're nearing kind of the high end of historical valuation ranges on the bond side. Where are we when it comes to loans?
Yeah, so loans are almost bang on the 50th percentile if you're looking at spreads. There's a little nuance to the story. The higher end performing part of the market is a little bit tighter. The stressier end of the market tends to be wider. So if you look at that average, it's a little misleading. If you wanted to invest in high quality double B or high quality single B loans, for example, your spreads aren't quite as wide, but it's pretty reasonable compensation relative to history, particularly if you look at the credit quality of those single B and double B assets. We don't think there's a very high probability of default from that cohort.
Yeah.
If there are defaults, and we given the strength of the economy, we very well may be past peak defaults, but it'll be in that lower end of the market, that sub 85, sub 80 price portion of the market, which is only around 8% of the loan market. And the investors have been predicting a default cycle now going on for almost 2 years. So a lot is in the price of those lower quality assets.
Okay, so obviously you got a pretty good story here. You have 9%-ish coupons. You have very steady, predictable monthly returns like you were talking about. You have valuations that don't look super expensive relative to history. I mean, I'm just curious in terms of the major risks here. So you think about, you were just alluding to, you know, what the picture is when it comes to defaults. I mean, I think one of the concerns that you hear about is, okay, well, higher for longer, great for the investor receiving the income, but, you know, more onerous for the borrower. So I'm just curious of how you're thinking about that. I mean, is that basically the situation that you were just saying, is you're kind of like triple C credits, potentially an issue, everything else probably able to deal with it? And then from a portfolio management perspective, I mean, I'm curious, you know, are you and a team kind of dipping down into that lower rated end of the spectrum, or do you feel like you can earn a sufficient return kind of staying up in quality?
Yeah, so I think you're right on the first part, that higher rates, to the extent that comes to pass, or even just rates remaining where they are, does impact the lower quality portion of the loan market a lot more. And if we're going to see defaults as a result of that, that's where it will come from. The what we'll call single B, double B type par credits are refinancing in the market today, and you model out their cash flow, and they can more than handle current rates without an issue. Leverage is reasonable. And even if you go up 50, 100 basis points from here, not really going to change the story. So when you're constructing a portfolio of these loans, you do have to, and frankly want to have, some portion of that lower quality universe in your portfolio. Some of these are good credits with bad balance sheets, or they need some extra time, they need some extra liquidity. We have those capabilities. We pick our spots. We do deep fundamental credit analysis, and we have entire teams of people typically staffed on these very complicated credit situations. So we do have some proportion of our portfolio there, but it's not dissimilar from the market. So if the market is less than 10%, most of our portfolios would be in that zip code.
Got it.
The other thing we didn't talk about is liability management exercises. It's a big issue in loans, less of an issue in bonds, just because the quality of the high yield index is much higher. But in managing this lower quality cohort, you have to be very aware of liability management situations. So for those that don't know, liability management is when loose documentation enables creative lawyers, companies, and sponsors, and frankly creditors, to disadvantage one creditor group against another. They do this for the purpose of either capturing discount or extending runway. There are not many ways to defend yourself against adverse liability management, but there are a couple. One of them is sort of obvious: run a really diversified portfolio. Mm-hmm. It's hard to generate alpha if you're too diversified, but that is a strategy.
Okay.
The other is to lean into situations that you like, to those, you know, good company, bad balance sheet situations, and make sure you're big enough to have an influence. So typically that means you're sitting on a steering committee and you're driving an outcome. You're driving a positive liability management outcome, hopefully for the company and certainly for yourself and your investors. And some of our really best trades over the last 12 months have been liability management exercises where we were on the steerco and we were driving our own outcomes.
Now, to be on the steerco and driving your own outcomes, I assume you need to be a fairly large player in the space. Is that true?
Absolutely. You have to be a large player in the space. You also have to have contacts at other funds that are large players in the space. You have to have good relationships with restructuring lawyers, restructuring advisors. And you have to have a deep network.
Yeah. So clearly a great example of where, you know, having a very large established platform globally and having all the relationships with all the market participants and stakeholders that you mentioned. That's a great example of that. Well, listen, that was, I think, a great overview on the loans. I think you make a compelling case as to, you know, why loans are attractive today. And I think that was a very, you know, realistic kind of overview of some of the risks that are involved as well. So I think that's really helpful. Let's transition to the bond side of things. So again, let me give the very simplistic way to look at it, and then you dispel me of my simplicities and help me understand what's really going on. But so I think the common narrative out there that I see is that, you know, credit spreads are tight relative to history, and therefore maybe there's not much more value to be wrung out of high yield bonds today. So tell me, is that right? I'm sure there's more nuance, but how are you thinking about bonds, generally speaking?
Well, I'm glad you got me in here today, because spreads are about 25 wider.
That's true.
Month to date. Yeah. So your data might be a little stale.
Right.
But yes, we are optically snug on the U.S. side still, kind of in the mid-300s. Europe looks better. So if you do have a global portfolio like we do in many cases, having the flexibility to move between geographies to find the best opportunities can really create value. If you're looking at historical valuations, it's not necessarily apples to apples to the high yield universe you have today. So first in terms of quality, and second in terms of duration. So on the quality front, we're over 50% double B's. I'm using a global benchmark, but US and Europe are similar.
Okay.
It was probably 10% less than that a decade ago. And perhaps more importantly, we're 10% triple C's. It was double that a decade ago.
Okay.
One of the important things to remember, we're using ratings as a sort of general guideline for credit quality. But if you look at the risk to high yield, it's below investment grade. Defaults are what you're primarily concerned about. If you look at defaults 12 months in advance of a default, and I'm quoting some JP Morgan data, but this is an average over 22 years, double B's, or a company rated double B, will default within 12 months less than 0.5% of the time. So half our market is double B's. Double B's just don't default, or it's extremely rare.
Right.
Single B's, that same stat is about 2%.
Okay.
So most of your defaults are coming from that triple C cohort. In other words, people typically can see it coming more than 12 months in advance. And that cohort's just a very small proportion of the overall market. So spreads don't look as rich if you adjust for the quality of the index.
10 years ago, much riskier market optically, if you're looking at it from a credit rating perspective.
The other consideration is the market is short. So Duration in the U.S. is only about 3.3 years. It's about 2.8 years in Europe. So if you look at the spread per unit of duration, it's in the 40th percentile over the last 3 years. I only saw three-year data because this came from a sell-side report last week. But if you sort of break it down per unit of duration, it's more attractive. The other thing to think about is about 25% of the market comes due in the next 3 years. CFOs, that's higher than typical. The reason for that is we've had this environment of suppressed interest rates, low coupons. And if you're a CFO sitting in a boardroom and you have this really low coupon, it's almost like having a really low mortgage. You're not going to rush out there and refinance it. So CFOs have sort of waited as long as they can. And at some point, they have to refinance. Even if they have a low coupon, their bonds are trading below par, they're not going to wait until the day before maturity to refinance those bonds, especially for sub-investment grade issuers. So typically, CFOs don't want their bonds to go current. So current would be your bonds are still outstanding within 12 months of the maturity. Okay. And typically, they'll refinance 12 to 18 months in advance of a maturity. So if you have 25% of the index coming due within the next 3 years, you have this strong pull to par for a pretty large portion of the index, which is coming from that refinancing activity. So yes, spreads are optically tight. Different parts of the curve are more attractive than others, which is why you need an active manager to invest in the right places. But in general terms, you're still making an 8% return for a higher quality index than you've had typically. And it's very short. It's a 3.3 year duration.
Now, when you say 8% return, are you talking about the yield?
That's a yield.
Yeah.
And that's a yield to worst. So that's not making worst. If you have a low coupon, you're trading below par is typically going to be maturity. So a lot of those are going to come out ahead of the maturity.
Right.
So you could argue that that's even understating the potential return. But if you have a little spread widening on the back end, you have a little pull to par effect on the front end. 8% for a high quality index.
Right.
Over, you know, that doesn't have huge sensitivity to spread moves. Seems pretty good to us.
And then in terms of, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked you for loans, which is, you know, going back to the health of the borrowers, right? So you're talking about CFOs needing to refinance. They've been putting it off. Now here they are, they're looking at the same data we are. They're looking at the same Jay Powell speech we are. And it seems like, okay, rates are probably not going lower anytime soon. So maybe they're a little bit more incentivized now to refinance their bonds. How are you thinking about that? Is it the same kind of picture when it comes to loans, where it's really only the triple C credits that are the big worries, or is there any difference or nuance when it comes to the bond side?
Well, you bring up a good point where some of that refinancing activity, because of this new higher for longer narrative, may actually be accelerated. Because if spreads are reasonable from the view of a borrower, and you don't think you're going to get a massive rate tailwind, then you certainly don't want to wait until 12 months before your maturity. You're just going to hit the market while it's open. And that's a better return for investors. Yes, same thing on triple C's. Even with the triple C cohort, the economic backdrop is really strong. And as refinancing takes place, those companies are refinancing into higher coupons. So it is more of a problem than it is for higher quality issuers, but not something we see that's going to cause an imminent, larger than typical default cycle, or larger than typical default rate, I should say. And when you think about a cycle, you think about a spike, and I really don't think we're going to see a spike. Defaults have been very manageable, and we expect more of the same.
Got it. Okay. So net, loans and bonds, based on what you said earlier in terms of where you all are, in terms of the allocations of your multi-asset strategies, positive stories, you know, a lot to like on both sides, but loans seem to be an outlier in terms of value today. Am I kind of paraphrasing that?
I think that's right. Loans really kind of jump off the page, and it really is that simple as 75 basis points a month, mm-hmm. With not a lot of default risk in our mind. Mm-hmm. I don't think you need to overthink it.
Yeah, yeah.
So we love loans, but high yield has its reasons for being attractive as well, and that's because you're earning a good return for a relatively short duration asset class that's higher quality than it's been in a long time.
Okay. Now, I already asked you about credit quality and the potential for defaults, but let's talk about what else could derail this story. I know that you and the team are professional worriers about downside risk. And so let's talk about some of those things that you all are worried about, or at least the risk that you are really trying to actively manage. So what could derail this whole story?
So I don't think the market is set up for a reacceleration of inflation. Mm-hmm. So pushing cuts to the right is fine. Staying on hold, so higher for longer, I think is okay. Mm-hmm. But a reacceleration that caused the Fed to actually have to go the other way mm-hmm. and start hiking again would be problematic mm-hmm. for risk assets. Mm-hmm. So that's something to watch.
Okay. And how? What would be the mechanism that would be problematic? Would it be directly impacting the health of the borrowers and their ability to, you know, manage their financial obligations, or is there something else?
So it's through Fed policy, the Fed would hike rates mm-hmm. in an attempt of slowing down the economy. I think history has proven that the Fed can ultimately be successful in what it wants to do, particularly if that is slowing down the economy. It's just a matter of degree. Mm. So the Fed has plenty of tools to dampen inflation, but they tend to be pretty painful for economic activity. Mm-hmm. So that's really the mechanism by which it happens. Yep. And borrowers are impacted, yes, by higher rates flowing through in terms of certainly loans immediately flowing through, bonds flowing through on a lag. But I think the bigger impact is, first of all, the market reaction, mm-hmm. that negative reaction, the impact on sentiment. So companies pull back, they don't spend. It's almost sort of a self-fulfilling.
Yeah.
And it's the massive impact to economic activity that really hurts borrowers mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and hurts our market.
Yep. Anything you can do about that in terms of managing that risk, or is it just?
Sure. There's lots of things you can do if that's your base case, mm-hmm. But it's not our base case at all. Mm-hmm. We think the economy is going to remain strong, but we do think the 500 basis point increase in rates that we've had, give or take, will have an effect. That effect is on a lag. Mm-hmm. Corporates that have locked in duration hits them on a lag. Consumers that have locked in mortgages are not feeling it. But over time, and we've seen early signs of, you know, cracks here and there, delinquencies in sort of lower income segments of the market. Mm-hmm. So I think over time you will see more of that. That's the scenario that we're positioning for, rather than a rapid reacceleration of inflation that causes the Fed to be a lot more hawkish.
Yep. Makes sense. What else is out there? Anything else that is a major risk on the horizon?
Well, if term premiums come back in a big way, I think that could be very disruptive mm-hmm. to markets.
And how do you define a term premium?
Well, so a term premium is the amount of additional compensation you need to go out on the curve, mm-hmm. to go longer. So right now, the Treasury curve is inverted or somewhat inverted, depending on what part of the curve you're looking at. But a term premium would be that curve steepening. They would call it bear steepening in the case that I'm worried about, which means the long end would go a lot higher than the short end is increasing. So mm-hmm. term premium would increase, for example, if sentiment shifted such that there were real concerns about deficit spending.
Yep.
So we're running a deficit of 7% of GDP at a time when unemployment is less than 4% in an expanding economy. If we go into some sort of a slowdown or recession, that deficit is going to expand. And there's a real, or I'm at least concerned that if term premiums came back in a big way, mm-hmm. that would be disruptive to markets.
Yeah. Okay. Is there any obvious catalyst? Because this is obviously something that has been a worry kind of on and off probably for whatever, a decade or more. Is there any obvious catalyst? I mean, is it the election or, I mean, it's not like, it seems like, it doesn't seem like either one of the, you know, two major candidates is calling for big austerity packages
or anything like that. Definitely not.
Yeah.
It could be, there's no catalyst. It's hard to predict these sentiment shifts or what the catalyst is for a sentiment shift. And at least I personally, and I think our team is not predicting that there is going to be real concerns around the deficit such that our markets are impacted for some period of time. Certainly it's not in our kind of 6 to 12 or 18 month investment horizon.
Yep.
Could it be a big issue for the 2028 election? Definitely. Is it an issue for this election? Unlikely. But you said what could derail it? And it's the sort of the risk that the market's not positioned for is what derails things.
Yeah.
And I think that that's another risk that the market is not positioned for.
Okay. Last one, I wanted to ask you about geopolitics. You know, we're seeing headlines every day. Some of them are pretty worrying. Is that something that's on the radar of you and your team?
So it's definitely on the radar. Geopolitics are always an issue, but I think it'd be disingenuous to claim that it's normal. We have a hot war in Ukraine, which is right next door to NATO country. We have an armed conflict in the Middle East, very close to a hot war between Iran and Israel. So certainly geopolitics are a risk, a big risk. The challenge with positioning for geopolitics is one, it's very hard to predict the outcome. And perhaps even more importantly, even if you could predict the outcome perfectly, it's even more difficult to predict the market's reaction to that outcome.
Yep.
There's been numerous examples, but the one that sticks out in my mind, and this is not a political statement at all, but in 2016, Trump was clearly the underdog. I was not expected to win. And then I think what surprised people even more was that stocks rallied during the 4 weeks after he won.
Yep.
So if you had known in advance that Trump was going to be the quote-unquote upset victor, I don't think investors' first thought would be, well, I'm going to go out and buy stocks.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So it's very challenging. I think the way that you insulate your portfolio from geopolitics is to just keep a diversified portfolio that is durable and continue to monitor the situation closely and, you know, react accordingly.
Makes sense. Well, that is helpful to hear some of the big risks that are out there. I mean, yeah, some of them are, I can imagine, are very difficult to try to manage a portfolio with those in mind. But it sounds like there's some pretty ways you can be pretty smart about it. Well, let's land the plane here. I want to thank you for joining, first of all. But let me just ask you, you know, we covered a lot of ground here, talked about loans, talked about bonds, talked about the macro kind of background and some risks. Any parting words you'd like to leave folks with? So let's say maybe somebody has an allocation to below investment grade credit or is considering it. Anything you'd like to kind of leave them with today?
Well, I hope I highlighted that the economy is strong, corporate balance sheets are in decent shape, and all-in yields are still attractive. Loans are a particularly attractive opportunity right now. But whether you're talking about loans or bonds, U.S. or Europe, it's important to remember that these are below investment grade asset classes. You need a big team with boots on the ground doing the credit work, and understanding all the nuances of these different situations to be successful in that credit selection, which is ultimately the most important driver of returns.
Yep, it all comes back to that credit analysis and credit selection.
So, yep.
Well, thank you, Brian. This has been awesome. Really appreciate it. And I'm sure our listeners have as well. Thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to or watching this episode of Streaming Income. If you'd like to stay up to date on our latest thoughts on asset classes ranging from high yield and private credit to real estate, debt, and equity, make sure to follow us and leave a review on your favorite podcast platform. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and more. And if you have specific feedback, you can email us at podcast@bearings.com. That's podcast@bearings.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next time.